I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. Map making is an exact science, except when it comes to redrawing the lines of congressional districts. It happens every 10 years just after the new census data is released, and that's when the high-minded stuff of creating a representative government begins. Ha! In reality, reapportionment is a combination of self-interest, venality, hardball politics, and the law. It has always been thus, and Massachusetts has always played a leading role, starting in 1812 when the state's governor, Elbridge Gerry, carved out a district for political purposes, a district that looked like a salamander, hence the term gerrymander, or if you want to be really accurate in your pronunciation, gerrymander. This year, the Bay State Speaker, Tom Finneran, is making headlines with his own redistricting plan that just happens to obliterate one of his critics. But Finneran's plan is only one of dozens across the country causing political pain and outrage. Here, as elsewhere, race is an important subtext, with the Voting Rights Act providing both opportunities and aggravations. And here, as elsewhere, there are both genuine concerns about minority representation, and there are crocodile tears, too. Connection listeners, we're sizing up the shape of politics for decades to come and considering the issues at the heart of congressional redistricting and what it means for you. Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us online at theconnection.org. I'm joined now by Ron Elving, the Washington editor for National Public Radio, who just happens to be my boss, and who I've conscripted here today. Ron, thanks for coming. I know it's a busy day for you.
It's my pleasure, Nina.
Redistricting isn't an issue that grabs a lot of headlines, but it does have an enormous impact. Why is it an issue that people should care about and should pay attention to?
Well, it's like if you care about baseball, it matters to you what the distance is to the fence that you have to hit a home run over. It matters what distance it is between first base and second base. All the ground rules by which the game is played matter because, in the end, the game itself is a very closely contested game of inches, so it really matters what kind of a field you're playing it on. And that's what we're talking about with redistricting. It shapes the field on which politics will be played. Now, this goes all the way back to the Constitution, and we've had it every 10 years since then, and it's frequently been highly contentious. In fact, there was one period in our history in the 1920s when the census numbers and the reapportionment that followed were so controversial that they basically couldn't even get the process done. They couldn't even get the states to agree to a formula for reapportionment. Now that's all done by computer. It's all been worked out, and we apportion the districts among the states. There are always 435 seats in the House, so we have to apportion them among the states to reflect population changes, who's growing faster, who's growing slower. And then when you've been given your 2, 3, 4, 5, up to the total of 53 in California seats, you have to draw the lines to decide where those seats are. How many are in L.A.? How many are in San Francisco? How many are in the Central Valley? Or in the case of Massachusetts, how many are going to be in the Boston area? How many are going to be outstate? How many are going to be out west? You have to decide where exactly those lines are going to be, and that's where the precise science you were talking about in map making comes in, because it really does get down to being house by house and street by street.
And it is a battle much like that. Give me an overview of where the most contentious places are. Are they the states that have actually lost seats, or are they the states where one party controls both houses of the legislature and the governorship?
All of the above, really any state that has more than one representative in Congress. And, of course, there are a number of states that only have one. Vermont, for example, only has one seat. Redistricting there is very simple. But as soon as you get up to New Hampshire's two, you're going to have a war. You're going to have some kind of a fight because even if, for example, everybody in the state's a Republican, you're still going to have an argument back and forth over where exactly you draw the line and who's going to represent a particular part of the state, because all the people who might want to run for Congress someday, many of them are already in the state legislature, and they're drawing the lines to decide who gets the more favorable district for them personally. So it can get down to just literally me against you personal kinds of relationships, even before we get to questions of race or questions of party.
Now, In most states, the decision is made by the legislature, with the governor having an ability to veto. In, a few states, a handful of states, there's a commission.
Mm-hmm. There's a wonderful little commission in Iowa where they get together with a lot of high-minded citizens, and they draw the maps as fairly as they possibly can. And supposedly they don't make any effort whatsoever to protect incumbents. And they, in essence, take all the politics and, if you may allow me to say parenthetically, all the fun out of it. That's great where it's done that way, and then it usually has to be ratified, of course, by some political body. But if it's done in a properly high-minded fashion, then theoretically the political body has to fall in line and approve it.
Let's take a state that has quite bemused me this year as an example of venality, and it goes both ways. I mean, but let's take a look at Michigan, and which is controlled both in both legislative bodies by the Republicans and a Republican governor. And describe what's happened there.
Well, there you have the highly contentious figure, if you will, of Dave Bonnier, who has been the number two figure in Democratic politics in the House of Representatives for a number of years, was the Democrats' designated hitter to go after Newt Gingrich during the years that Newt Gingrich was Speaker, has been a highly partisan figure, a man who is, generally speaking, considered a liberal Democrat and certainly is on economic issues, but also has been on some other issues a social conservative, but is generally seen as a very strong partisan Democrat. And he represents an area that's often referred to as the birthplace of the Republic of the Reagan Democrats, if you will, the ground zero for the Reagan Democrats, which is Macomb County outside of Detroit. And it's a place where a lot of blue-collar, traditionally Democratic voters live and moved in the period after World War II, and became increasingly concerned about some of the social trends and economic trends that they saw, and became highly susceptible to a Republican message, especially when it was carried by Ronald Reagan. But they still voted Democratic for other offices, largely, and particularly for David Bonnier. And David Bonnier's district has to be drawn just right for him to be able to survive, because if you start to draw in too many people from further out suburbs, he suffers. And if you start to draw in too many people from the city of Detroit, you may be very likely bringing in a lot of African-American voters who might very well prefer an African-American candidate in the primary over Dave Bonnier. Now, if you don't draw that district in a friendly fashion for Dave Bonnier, he's probably not going to be able to survive. So when the Republicans are in control, they don't worry too much about saving Dave Bonnier. And because Michigan has to lose, because their population isn't growing as fast as the national average, then it makes it pretty easy to see who's going to be the guy left out without a chair when the music stops.
And it's Dave Bonnier.
Exactly.
But there's more to it than that. At the moment, I think the Michigan delegation is, I'm trying to remember, 9 Democrats, 6 Republicans or something.
That sounds right.
And after this redistricting, if it's successful, and there still can be court challenges, we'll get to that in a minute, if it's successful, it'll be reversed. And among other things, they've put 2 Democrats into one district. And one of those 2 is John Dingell, the dean of the House, who's been there, you know, longer than anybody else.
Since the 50s,
and a very powerful member of the House of Representatives. So that's sort of it. Michigan, in some ways, shows you what can be done. The Democrats are reciprocating in Maryland, as I understand it, in Georgia, in Alabama, and maybe in California. But in California, the Democrats had hoped to pick up several seats, or at least 2, and it now appears they may not be able to do that without causing some problems for their minority members who want more majority minority districts, Latino, particularly Latino districts, and they can't do that and pick up seats. So it may Yeah, go ahead.
You raise one of the other dimensions of all this. Between party is one of the things we talk about, but within party is also a very substantial issue. And you raise the issue of ethnicity and race. And really, in the years since the 1960s, the main focus of all the contention over redistricting has increasingly been race. And that is because the Voting Rights Act of 1965 said that any practices that tended to work against the interests of minority group members, which they meant African Americans primarily, but it's come to mean equally Hispanics, and to a much lesser degree, eventually it will mean Asian Americans, any kind of a restriction on their political rights whatsoever was prohibited and was unconstitutional, according to many of the rulings that were made by the Supreme Court in connection with those same issues and the Voting Rights Act of 65. So a lot of the back and forth and a lot of the court challenges have had to do with whether or not the states were doing enough to guarantee representation for the voters and representation in Congress for people who were African American or Hispanic.
There's been a rather interesting, what I would call, reversal of fortunes and the whole question of minority representation. 10 years ago, it was the Democrats who were saying to the Supreme Court, and often losing, in fact, with a more conservative court, saying, look, we want heavily majority-minority districts, because we want to guarantee that our minority members, our minority voters, have at least some representation. Well, they got what they wanted in many ways, and it turned out to something to their disadvantage, because in guaranteeing majority-minority districts, they bled off some of their most loyal supporters for other Democrats. And now they don't want to pack them as hard into one district. And in fact, even the minority representatives, like, for example, Bobby Scott in Virginia, say, look, I don't need a 60% or a 55% majority district. I'm fine if you give me a 48% majority district. But the Republicans now want to pack them in the way they were opposing doing a decade ago. A reversal of fortunes?
Yes, indeed. And it also illustrates the old adage that many of the most important questions in politics, as in life, are not questions of kind, but of degree. It's not just which direction you go, it's how far you go in that particular direction. Now, the court directed that you could not, in a state, let's take Mississippi as an example, you could not create districts on the Mississippi map that divided the Delta region of the state into the maximum number of districts so as to dilute African-American voting strength, as was once attempted so many years ago. You had to create districts in which African-American voters had a fair shot of dominating at least one district or possibly two. That has been done. Then the question becomes, how much do you make that one black district or those two black districts not only somewhat African-American or predominantly African-American, but overwhelmingly African-American, which guarantees two things. One, that it's going to elect whoever the African-Americans most want. Number two, that that person is probably going to be African-American. And then by extension, in current voting patterns, it's probably going to be a Democrat. Now, Democrats liked that for a while, as you suggest. But then as you started to move some more and more black voters into a given district, and it therefore made it more difficult for Democratic candidates, white or black, to win in an adjoining district, then the Democrats didn't like it so much. Let's shift over to the example of Georgia after the 1990 census. Georgia, a generation ago, had maybe one Republican, and the rest of the delegation was all Democratic. That was the case when Newt Gingrich was first in Congress. Then later, after the 1990 census, the state was growing quite a bit. They created three districts where a black representative could be elected. Three Democrats were elected. And all the rest of the seats in the state became Republican white districts. And the state of Georgia became one of the most predominantly Republican states in the Union. And the Democrats didn't like that very much. So that's the reversal of fortune that you're talking about. And that's what the Democrats are trying to work on after this particular census.
Ron Elving, Washington editor for NPR, thanks so much for joining us. I'm hoping in the break to con you into staying for a couple more minutes, but if I don't, thank you. Connection listeners, we're tracing the lines of congressional districting this hour. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Nina Totenberg. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. And I'm joined by National Public Radio's Washington editor, Ron Elving, who, as I said earlier, just happens to be my boss. And we're also going to be joined now by Sam Hirsch, a partner at the Washington, D.C. law firm Jenner & Block, who represents Impact 2000, which is the Democratic Party redistricting project, and by Tom Hoffler, who's the redistricting director for the Republican National Committee. Thank you all for joining me in this hour. Ron, let me go back to you for a second. The Republicans are saying that they think they may pick up as many as 12 seats this year through redistricting. The Democrats are scoffing at that. Where do you think that the reality lies, and where are we so far?
Well, it might just sound cheap to say that you probably want to split the difference. I would guess my feeling has been that since so much of the faster growth in the country is in what some people call the red states, it depends on whether you mean red or blue to be Bush states on the particular map that you draw. But if let's call them Bush states, states that voted for George W. Bush, and in many cases overwhelmingly in 2000, if you look at those states, that's where a lot of the growth is in the country, and that's where a lot of the districts are moving. When Pennsylvania gives up two, and New York gives up two, and other states like Michigan give up districts, those are all states that voted for Al Gore in the last presidential election, and they're moving primarily to states that voted for George W. Bush. Now, that means that usually in those same states, the Republicans are in a strong position to pick up a seat, because if there's a new seat there and there are a lot of Bush voters there, any kind of fair redistricting at all where they can get one, or if they control the process, should get them another seat in that state. So just on that basis alone, they should have an advantage. And I would say that given that a little over a score of seats are moving, they should be able to pick up a net in the high single digits. Now, maybe it will be in the double digits. The Democrats are saying it's going to be a wash. I suspect it'll be in the high double digits.
Sam Hirsch, you're the Democrats' lawyer on this. Answer him.
Well, I think that Ron's answer focused primarily on reapportionment, and it's true that the bulk of the states losing seats are ones where Gore won. The bulk of states gaining seats are ones that Bush won, which would suggest that the whole process will favor the Republicans. But if you start looking within each state, then I think that the picture is a lot less clear, and in fact may tilt our way. Let me give you two example reasons why. One is that the old plans, by and large, have a significant pro-Republican bias, and simply by redrawing to reflect population shifts within each state, we're likely to undo that. Let me give you numbers here. As you probably know, Gore actually got 500,000 votes, more than Bush, yet Bush carried 228 districts to Gore's 207, a 21-seat advantage for the guy that got fewer votes. And the reason is that the current plans, and in effect now, aren't unbiased. The most lopsided, non-competitive districts in the country are Democratic districts. So I think just straightening that out will greatly benefit the Democrats. The other thing is it's very much a state-by-state process, and we have a lot of states now with split legislatures or with legislatures under the control of one party and governors under the control of another party, and in those instances, it's very probable that this whole process will end up in the courts. And what comes out of the court system, I can say as a redistricting lawyer, is always a bit uncertain. But we're seeing battles in many, many states fought out not only in federal court this time around, but in state courts as well. And often those state judges are themselves elected. We don't have much of a track record of seeing how state judges will act in this highly politicized arena. And I think when you put in all these X factors, the best guess we can have is that this will be roughly a wash.
Tom Hoffler, you're the lawyer or the redistricting director for the Republicans. On the subject of courts, in Texas, the Republicans had expected to pick up two or three seats anyway, and now that seems in doubt because there is a disagreement. They can't reach agreement in the state, and the matter is apparently going to a federal court, which the Republicans apparently see as considerably less politically friendly.
Well, Nina, I have to correct one thing. I'm not an attorney. I'm just a PhD. Texas is a good example, though, of some of the legal confusion that's going on. Indeed, there are multiple lawsuits in multiple kinds of court. So we're both in state and federal court in Texas, and this is going to play out over the next few months, and we'll see which court in which venue or which courts in which venue will actually end up being the ultimate line drawer.
You know, I think Texas actually is a perfect example of what's going on within states. The huge area of growth in Texas is in the Hispanic population. Hispanics in Texas vote roughly 70-30 Democratic, and that's why there's real prospect for Democratic gain in Texas. And in any event, no reason at all that Democrats should backslide there in terms of numbers. You see that in many states that are high growth areas where the state as a whole may have voted for Bush, but the areas of growth are Hispanics and Asians and other Democratic leaning constituencies.
Yes, but what Sam fails to mention here is that the other high growth area in Texas was in the suburbs, and so that will also play into it. And unraveling the gerrymander that the Democrats performed on Texas last time should be a benefit to the Republicans.
Ron Elving, why do you think that other than sort of the overall red state analysis, why do you think that the Republicans will pick up as much as 12 seats? And I'm wondering also whether you've seen any internal polling data that has either party worried about sort of a national trend, whether, you know, in off-year elections, for example, usually the party in power at the White House loses seats.
That is true. That has been the historical pattern, although all historical patterns have been a little bit looser and have been frequently violated in the last 10, 12 years. It seems the Clinton era was largely about upsetting historical precedents. My own guess is that their pickups will be in single digits. But, you know, one thing we should mention before we talk any more about 2002 is that the most important factor in that election will probably not be redistricting. It will probably be the state of the economy. I think most everybody agrees on that. But if the economy muddles along fairly well or recovers strongly, if there is no really enormous political effect from an economic situation, then I think that probably the redistricting outcomes and the new seats that are created and that are open will be the determiner of which party controls the House after that election. And I think a lot of those battles will be fought in the suburbs. And I think Tom is right. The suburban growth in the Sun Belt states or in the high growth states is still favoring the Republican Party. Karl Rove, who is the close political advisor to George W. Bush, likes to say that when you see these new churches, for example, that are being built out in some of the suburban growth areas and the exurban growth areas beyond, many of these new churches are not part of the old line denominations. Many of them don't even have a familiar name or a denomination that they're associated with. And the voters in those churches are frequently very heavily oriented towards voting for the Republican Party, and they particularly like George W. Bush. So assuming that he continues to have their loyalty, and assuming that the economy putters along and doesn't go into a recession, I think something in the high single digits will be what we'll wind up with as a gain for Republicans just from redistricting.
The number to call is 1-800-423-8255, and we have Ron on the line with a question for Ron, I think. Go ahead, Ron.
Hi, my name is Ron as well. The thing that I don't understand is why is the number of representatives fixed? It seems that if there's been 435 since we've had 50 states, that each congressperson is representing fewer people, more people, which doesn't seem like a good idea. And I just never understood why we can't just increase the number of congresspeople to make this easier on everybody.
Ron Elving?
Well, I guess the simple answer is because the House of Representatives chamber couldn't possibly accommodate all the bodies that would take. It is a live argument among political scientists, and many people say that now that we're up to 600,000, 700,000 people in some congressional districts, that these people are just being strained to represent far too many people, particularly to represent them in the way that House members were intended to represent them, which was almost on a personal basis. I mean, some of these members of the House, more and more of them, represent more people than some senators represent. And that was not the original intent of the framers. On the other hand, if we're going to keep up with population, and we've had 435 representatives now since the early years of the 20th century, a little over about 100 years we've had that number. If we were going to keep up with population, the House would just continue to expand indefinitely. You would get into the thousands of members, and it would get to be difficult for them to have any kind of relationships with each other. So the equilibrium that's sought, that is difficult to strike, is between the relationships that members can have with each other, which are idealized by a smaller House, and the relationships they can have with their constituents, which could obviously be closer if the districts were smaller and we got back to 200,000 or 300,000 people per representative.
What caused the increase at the beginning of the 20th century, and how big was the increase? I mean, what event or series of events actually made the Congress expand itself?
To some degree, it was explosive population growth in the years after the Civil War, but there had always been the feeling that some states were being underrepresented because they were growing faster than some of the older states. And there was a great deal of sectional, regional rivalry involved. And ultimately, it was determined that the House should fix its number because they had been kind of bouncing around, and that was annoying to all parties. And it was fixed by a constitutional amendment.
Okay, thanks very much, Ron Elving. I know you have to go, and we have another guest joining us on the line, Tom Finneran, the Speaker of the House in Massachusetts. Mr. Speaker, thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Nina Totenberg. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
This is truly an honor.
Well,
to do anything live with Nina Totenberg, I've become so accustomed to hearing your voice and accepting guidance, moral, spiritual, political, and otherwise, but it's sort of from afar. You just come over the airwaves. It's magic.
Flattery will get you maybe nowhere. my question for you, Speaker Finneran, sitting in a studio in Boston, is Massachusetts is not one of those states that has lost a representative. It has maintained its number of representatives. And you are a Democrat and the Speaker of the House. You are sponsoring a reapportionment plan that would obliterate the seat of Congressman Martin Meehan. And your critics say that that is because Congressman Meehan has been the primary sponsor of campaign finance reform in the state as well as nationally that you oppose.
I understand that that's what the critics say, and no matter how many times you deny that you had nothing to do with it, or the two are not linked, your critics, will generally jump to the worst conclusions, even though there's little evidence for that other than the surmise within their own heads. What we had here in Massachusetts was an unusual situation, which I acknowledged right up front when we rolled out the plan. And it was this, that Marty himself had indicated a very strong interest and a powerful interest, personal interest in running for governor. He had done things far and wide beyond his district. He had hired special campaign operatives. He had leaked to reporters consistently for month after month after month that he was likely to go. He had spoken at the most recent convention. My wife and I received glossy campaign brochures from him, and we live many, many miles from his present district. And so I thought that there was a body of evidence, and this is exactly what I said, that indicated that it was as likely as not that he was going to run for governor. Wasn't dispositive either way, but there was enough evidence out there to suggest that he was. And based upon that assumption, which I acknowledged could be erroneous, but at the time, nobody had indicated, including Marty, otherwise.
But Mr. Speaker, he's already said he's not going to run for governor, so why not abandon the plan?
Well, because the plan articulates and advances principles that have been given lip service by many people, including a lot of Democrats, and who then run and flinch from advancing the principles behind the lofty rhetoric. The notion of coherent, compact communities of interest articulated by political people and embraced by the courts, and the notion of minority-majority districts that don't create the issue of packing and cracking, but do create a legitimate political opportunity for the enfranchisement of minorities, are things that I wanted to try to advance. But I said, Nina, when I rolled it out, if Marty ultimately made a decision on his own timetable that he was not a candidate for governor, my mind was open, the door was open, the plan was open. All it is a proposal. But it is interesting to watch the reaction of the political players who try to say, well, it's not perfect. I'm waiting for them to come out with something that now recognizes incumbency protection as a legitimate factor, but do something legitimate which advances minority-majority political interest in districts, and stop the ribbon-cutting that's gone on here in Massachusetts.
There is already a district that is a majority-minority district. It does not have a minority representative because
There is no existing minority district, Nina. I hate to dispute you.
Isn't there a 51% district now?
No, there is not.
Isn't the Cambridge district a 50%?
It's about a 45 or 46% district. The one that I've created presently moves it by taking Cambridge out and adding some more minority areas in, creates it at gets it close between 51 and 52, and the demographics, which is a huge factor because this is a 10-year plan, Nina.
But,
you have
but
to look
Mr.
at the
Speaker,
price of
but Mr.
where
Speaker,
the minority trends, where the minority communities are growing.
Mr. Speaker, though, the minority community opposes your plan. I mean, this is a bit of an odd thing.
It isn't, Nina, but you have to look closely at the criticism. They oppose it. because it doesn't create a guaranteed seat for them. They want a lock on it. You can't create a lock for anybody. You have
that's not the way I read their comments.
Oh, their comments. Well, yeah. That's the way I read their comments.
You know, as I look at this, you have created a plan that's got a lot of people mad at you. Are you ready to give it up yet?
No. Oh, absolutely not. No, I think this plan is worth airing out. I've suggested to the congressional delegation I'm interested in any counter proposals they might want to air out. I'm waiting for the Senate to propose and advance a plan, and I'm amenable to any reasonable discussion that would advance all three interests. I think Marty has raised a legitimate point on his own, and so has the delegation. Incumbency protection is legitimate. I embrace it. I do not disdain it. I'm not going to commit a political assault upon it. But I want to go further than what has been done in the past. If you look at the present map, Nina, it is appalling to look at. It is a disgrace. Worcester, which is 50 miles inland, runs to the southeast coast, as if it needs a warm water port to have some type of coherence as a congressional district.
Well, I looked at the map today, and I must tell you, one of the most compact districts is Marty Meehan's district. If I were just drawing a district based on compactness, I wouldn't be doing it around his area. I'd be doing it down in the south part of the state.
But you can't be just directed by compactness. You have to try to incorporate and accommodate several competing legitimate objectives. The community of interest objective is the one that is most frequently repeated by the Supreme Court in the guidance that they try to give on the case law around this. And southeastern Massachusetts, as you know, the orientation is around the triangle cities of Taunton, New Bedford, Fall River. The orientation is to Providence and toward the ocean, and it has been cut into ribbons to simply advance and to protect incumbents over many, many years. So the argument that's made against my plan seems to tell me this, because incumbency protection of a few folks 20 and 30 years ago was important then, that I am bound by that. I don't feel bound by it at all, and nobody else should, I think, because that would do a continuing injustice to the people in southeast Massachusetts, a continuing injustice to minorities, and it doesn't really do much other than save money.
We have to cut you off because we're at the end of a segment. We need to note for the record that Tom Birmingham, the president of the state senate, opposes your plan. So do apparently most of the members of the delegation and the minority community. So you've got a tall mountain to climb before you finish this one.
I have my gear on. I'm ready to go, Nina.
Thank you very much, Speaker Finneran. The number to call is 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Nina Totenberg. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston.
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. We're talking this hour about congressional redistricting and its potential imprint on the political landscape for decades to come. My guests this hour are Sam Hirsch from Impact 2000, that's the Democrats, and Tom Hoefler from the Republican National Committee. And I'm going to... That last little interview I did with Speaker Finneran, I think, is some indication of... smoke, mirrors, venality, sweetness and light, and all the things that go on. I'm going to read you something from the AP. And then, since I don't expect either of you to tell me what's the worst thing you're planning to do or have done, I'm going to ask you what the other guy's worst thing is. All right? This is from the
show's only an hour long. Time.
This is from the Associated Press.
That gives Sam an advantage, actually, because it gives me less time.
The details might be eye-glazing, but for politicians, this is life or death. Already there have been examples of how personal redistricting fights can get. In Oklahoma, Republican Governor Frank Keating proposed a remap that pits two fellow GOP congressmen against each other and leaves the state's lone Democrat mostly untouched. Who benefits? Candidate Kathy Keating, the governor's wife, running for an open seat. Keating allies have denied the governor was trying to help his wife. In Oregon, Democrats in the state house boycotted the Capitol for 5 days in an effort to stop a GOP-backed plan. Upset Republicans hired people to deliver summonses, ordering them back. None of the lawmakers could be found. In St. Louis, A city alderman refused to give up the floor in a filibuster, opposing a city redistricting map, and I guess we should say all of this, you know, this is it, redistricting all the way down, opposing a city redistricting map that she said would damage black representation. Denied a bathroom break, aides handed her a waste basket and held a tablecloth around her. Police cited her for urinating in public. "What I did behind the tablecloth is my business," Alderman Irene Smith said, successfully blocking the vote. So, dear listeners and dear guests, that gives you an idea of what we're talking about. It's the high-minded business of designing a method of representation, but it's a pretty down and dirty business, too. So let me go first to you, Mr. Hoffler. What's the worst thing the Democrats are either planning to or have done?
Well, first, I'd like to correct one impression that was given in the first part of the program and say that in the 1990 redistricting cycle, it was actually Democratic incumbents and Democrat legislatures that were blocking the creation of minority districts and had to be bludgeoned into submission by the Justice Department. This time around, I think we've had a great example in Georgia where the Democrats have resurrected an old weapon of redistricting called the multi-member district to keep Republicans from improving their numbers in the Georgia House of Representatives, a state redistricting. Multi-member districts are the way that you submerge minorities, and they used to do that to the African Americans, and now they're turning it on to the Republicans. How it's done is you essentially
have
two Democratic districts that you well, it's only because you have to create single-member districts in Congress that this probably hasn't happened, but you put two what would be two single-member Democratic districts with one Republican district, and you vote them all together, and suddenly the Republican disappears. Actually, in terms of Congress, the Democrats really haven't had much of a chance yet in the states that have been completed, so I think we'll have to stand by. We only have 78 of the congressional seats drawn at this time. We still have 350 left to go, and I'm sure we'll see some good examples.
Okay,
in the
Sam Hirsch, I have the feeling you're sitting there itching.
Yeah, grinding my teeth is more like it. There's so many examples, I don't know where to begin, but since you and Ron had discussed Michigan, let's talk about Michigan. There, as you pointed out, Democrats have a 9-7 advantage in the current delegation under a map that was drawn by a bipartisan panel of federal judges 10 years ago, a fair map, I would say. The Republicans, though, this time around, control everything, the House, the Senate, the governorship. But in 1999, when they feared that they might lose the Michigan House, they passed a very extensive statute controlling how congressional district lines would be drawn, with very specific requirements as to compactness and respect for counties and cities and so forth. And when it turns out that they actually had all the levers of power this year and they could draw lines however they wished, they rammed through literally in the middle of the night. I was there in Lansing at 2 in the morning when the thing finally passed. They rammed through with almost no advance warning a map that takes six of the nine Democratic incumbents and pairs them in three districts. It's not just Congressman Bonnier who's paired or Congressman Dingell. Six of the nine are paired, and none of the Republicans are paired. This is a state that Al Gore won, as Ron mentioned earlier, yet he would carry only 5 of the 15 new districts in this map. They rammed it through with terrible secrecy. They wouldn't even give out copies of the map electronically so people could look at them on the Internet like they do in other states. We had trouble even figuring out who was in which district. It went through in a perfect party line vote with only one brave Republican voting with the Democrats against this proposal. But it turns out in rushing it through and keeping it away from public scrutiny, they left about 4,000 or 5,000 people out of the map entirely, so they're not in any congressional district. And now the thing has been sitting there in the Senate, and they're trying to figure out, well, should we send it to the governor for a signature? It's obviously illegal because there's 5,000 people that aren't in any district. Or should we redo it? Or what should we do? And they're embarrassed, and they don't want to reopen the discussion because they're afraid that the Republicans will fly apart at the seams. And it's just a mess.
Mr. Hoffler, you want to respond?
That's just an example of the technical difficulties of redistricting. I'm sure they'll get the
that's politics,
the areas
not technology. Sorry.
Well, perhaps we'll see
bad
examples
politics
in the other direction in states where the Democrats will control.
But we'll best not that's leave 5,000 people out of the map.
Yeah, in the past, strange things have happened like that, too. There was also a state in the 90s where the governor forgot to veto a bill and it went into law and shouldn't have gone into law. So there are always these stories that happen about the problems of the process.
This wasn't inadvertent.
But yes,
these guys absolutely violated the act that they passed in 99 in order to run roughshod over the Democrats. And they appear to have gotten what they wanted. Now it's going to be up to the courts to correct it. But it's an absolute abuse of power.
All right. The number to call is 1-800-423-8255. Kathy is on the line. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. I'm glad that you took my call. I had a comment on the nationwide discussion of majority-minority districts, and I think in many of these redistricting plans, people forget that immigrants don't have the vote, so they have to be careful in calling it a majority-minority district when that does not apply to the people who can vote. And I know for...
Well, gentlemen, when a court or a legislature is designing districts and they are evaluating a population, are they looking at voting age population, eligible voting age population, or are they looking at overall population?
It's a difficult question. In the one-person, one-vote context, it's total population that matters. Congressional districts in a state have to have the same population. But when you're talking about minority districting questions, it really shouldn't be any of those things. It should be just a practical question of, will this district, in all probability, elect a candidate preferred by minority voters? If so, it should count as an effective minority district. If not, it shouldn't. The Republicans want to have bright-line rules and say, oh, no, districts have to be more than 50% black or more than 50% Hispanic or more than 50% Asian, which I think is sort of a divisive concept. And it also forces you to say, well, which population base matters? Is it voting age people? Is it citizens of voting age? Is it registered voters? You get into a lot of these issues. And to me, it's all a sideshow. The question is, do minority group members have the same opportunities as everybody else in society to elect their preferred candidates? If they do, it's a fair plan. If they don't, it's unfair and probably illegal plan.
Mr. Hoffler?
The Justice Department, in evaluating districts when they're approving plans under the Voting Rights Act, look at the voting strength of the minorities in the districts. And so it isn't really total population, your percentage of total population or your percentage of voting age population, it's the amount of vote that you actually bring to the polls. And I think one thing that the minorities, particularly Hispanics, have to be very careful of in following the new policies of the Democratic Party is not to bring the percentages down so low in their district that they end up not really truly being able to elect the candidate of their choice, particularly if that district no longer is held by an incumbent. So the power of incumbency should not necessarily be factored into that equation, because that district should be neutral on its face.
I agree with what Tom says. Unfortunately, it's not what the RNC does. In New Jersey, we had a case where there were three majority black districts in the Newark area in the state legislature. Democrats, black, white, and Latino came together and said, this is packing. These three districts should be reformulated into four, and that would allow blacks to elect their preferred candidates in four districts rather than three. And who fought that? The Republican Party. They fought it first in the state. They fought it then in federal court, and they lost in both places, fortunately.
And the Republicans
was,
are appealing,
50%.
Aren't they?
An argument was, no, you need effectiveness.
No, the Republicans are not appealing.
You're not appealing.
Well, and I think it's important to know.
Hold on, guys. Nobody can hear two of you at once. So, Mr. Hoffler, go ahead.
It's important to note that the special politics of New Jersey came to bear on the district in that county, and that is that the only reason that the African-American candidates won in that district was because the slating process was changed so that there wouldn't be a disaster there in their court record. Even so, while the white Senate president was carrying the district by a huge margin. The minority candidates just barely won nomination. So I think that there was an honest contention over whether or not that district was one where the minority population, if free from the slating process, would truly be able to elect the candidate.
We're
going
to go
choice.
To a call here. Greg is calling from Buffalo. Go ahead, Greg.
Yes, hi. I'm a county legislator in Erie County, New York, and we've just been ordered to run on our old lines, and weighted voting's been imposed on us by a federal court because of our failed reapportionment plan.
And is there another? How are you going to get a new reapportionment plan?
Interesting point. The federal court judge declined to impose a plan, instead ordered us to run under the existing lines, and then immediately imposed weighted voting on the body, which will throw an interesting dynamic into the whole process.
Well, what's weighted voting?
Every member there is assigned a number either above or below one based on the amount of population your district is off the average. So if I'm below, I'm at 0.88. I'm in the city. There's people in the suburbs where there's been movement that are at 0.17, and you have to add that up each time you vote. There's 17 of us.
So you vote for more than one person?
No, we vote for our percentage, either over or under the ideal, the one man one vote ideal. So that's how weighted voting would work. Yeah, everybody's assigned a percentage either above or below one, depending on how high or how old they are.
Maybe I'm stupid, but I don't understand this. Can either of you gentlemen help me?
The districts have remained the same, but because they have unequal populations, when the members actually go to the, I don't know if it's city council or county council, they have a different weight of vote. So, you know, one legislator actually has more oomph than the other just because his district has more people in it.
I see. Robin,
it's a rather novel solution, I might add.
Yes.
We have time for a very quick call from Robin. Very quickly, what's your question? Oops, she's gone. So that's that.
Nina,
yes.
I do want to just correct the record on one thing here. African Americans in New Jersey ran with party support and against party support, and in both instances did fine because these districts were effective minority districts, and that's what the Democratic Party stands for.
Well, as I read the lower court, the court's decision, what it said was that this was one of those circumstances where minority candidates were able to attract, there was not a lot of block voting, that they were able
Correct.
To attract non-minority votes, and that therefore this was a system that would work with four districts. Anyway,
exactly.
It's a little technical, folks, but in the end, it's who represents you. And I want to thank my guests this hour, Sam Hirsch from Impact 2000, and Tom Hoefler, who's the redistricting director for the Republican National Committee and not a lawyer but a PhD.
And thank you very much, Nina.
Earlier this hour, we spoke with Ron Elving, the Washington editor for NPR, and with Thomas Finneran, the Speaker of the Massachusetts House. Connection listeners, you can continue the redistricting conversation online at www.theconnection.org. I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners.